From Springfield, this is State Week, a program of analysis and commentary on the events that made news this past week in Illinois state government and politics.
I think that Exelon must move closer to where the General Assembly is for us to end up with a solid energy package that does well by ratepayers.
Education will be cut, colleges and universities will be cut, severe cuts to our human services. It's a very bad scenario.
It's the Illinois House Majority Leader Greg Harris warning if what Democrats call corporate tax loopholes are not closed, that will leave a hole in the state's budget and means cuts to key areas. Before that, Governor Pritzker responding to Exelon's latest effort to shake more money from state governments, warning of potential nuclear plant shutdowns. All of this and other pressing matters are before lawmakers, with about a week to go before the scheduled adjournment of the Illinois House and Senate. And we'll talk about it coming up here on State Week. I'm Sean Crawford in Springfield. Our panel today includes Charlie Wheeler, emeritus professor and former director of the Public Affairs Reporting Program at the University of Illinois Springfield. Charlie is also a longtime State House reporter and observer. Also with us, we have Hannah Meisel, NPR Illinois State House editor, and joining us, the Chicago Tribune's chief political reporter, Rick Pearson. And Rick, it's always good to have you with us.
Thanks very much, Sean.
Well, let's start. One of those pressing matters I mentioned, of course, is always the state's budget. And since there's been a lot of speculation on just how bad the situation or good the situation is for the state financially, let's start there. Hannah, where do things stand regarding negotiations on a new budget?
Well, I'm hearing negotiations in general are getting, you know, coming close to being done. But of course, now we had kind of a switch that the Democrats announced this week. If listeners will recall, last year, Illinois was the only state to have to, our finances were such that we had to take advantage of a Federal Reserve lending program. And so we borrowed money to get us through the end of fiscal year 2020 and for fiscal year 2021, the year that we're currently in and will end June 30th. We had hoped and planned to pay off that debt with the federal stimulus money the state has coming to us, about $8 billion from the American Rescue Plan. But of course, the US Treasury said, actually, you can't use that money to pay off debts. State had planned to appeal, but a decision, you know, might not come until summer. Democrats announced this week that actually we're going to pay off $2 billion of that debt from, you know, our just general revenue funds because the economy has recovered so well, and not rely on that federal stimulus money. And we'll, you know, spend that later, and we can spend that over a period of 4 years. But, you know, the thing that this does is it gives, it bolsters the governor's argument that, well, we still have this $1.3 billion deficit. And if we don't, you know, close the corporate income tax loopholes, like I've been suggesting since February, then we're going to be in a real world of hurt. You know, it gives him more leverage to do it this way.
So, Charlie, the budgets always have a long-term impact, but this one definitely will. There's a lot of that one-time revenue that's coming into the state, so it is kind of a key moment for state government, not just now, but going forward for a few years at least.
Yeah, the state is still in difficult financial times, and it will be going forward. The good news, as Hannah mentioned, is that the revenue estimates for the current fiscal year, the one that's going to end in 6 weeks or so, have been increased both by the governor's commission, by the governor's Office of Management and Budget, and by the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, because the economy has recovered better than people thought. And there's some sense that part of it is the federal money that's gone out, the stimulus payments to individuals and to businesses that have helped keep things going. But in any event, we're going to bring in somewhere in the neighborhood of $2 billion more than what was anticipated. And what the governor, the legislative leaders, the comptroller have decided to do is use that money to pay off the federal borrowing more sooner, more quickly, roughly a year and a half before what was the original schedule. And that's going to save us something like $100 million in interest. But that still leaves, as was mentioned, the fact that as things stand now, there's an imbalance of roughly a billion plus between what we have desired to spend, what we need to spend, and the money that's going to be there. And as Representative Harris suggested, if we can't find a way to come up with this additional billion plus, we're going to have to make some cuts. And they will be painful, because basically the budget was pretty much, that the governor introduced back in February, was pretty much a standstill budget. And the only significant change that he's accepted to so far is to add $350 million to the evidence-based school funding formula to meet a prior commitment. But other than that, it's pretty much holding steady. And so there's still challenges going forward. And interestingly enough, the estimate for next year, when the legislators forecasters, the Commission on Government Forecasting and Accountability, updated their FY22 revenue estimate, they only increased it by $792 million, which is not that big on a $42 billion base.
Rick, Pritzker himself, he has argued and warned of deep cuts needed in the past because of the state's budget situation. And some people, you know, might see this as just crying wolf. And Democrats don't really want to cut these areas. So, you know, how successful can this strategy be?
Well, one thing that people have pointed out to is, and this is particularly Republicans who feel that Pritzker's proposal for nearly $1 billion in business tax changes, as the governor calls them, closing corporate loopholes, that this is kind of a payback for the well-moneyed, well-heeled opponents of his plan for the graduated rate income tax. What you did have Leader Harris saying, that he's kind of got panels on a dual track, one group looking at, if we got to make $1.3 billion in cuts, where are they going to come out of? And then on a separate track is, of those nearly $1 billion in business tax changes, what is doable here? I think obviously the way that Leader Harris, including in the clip at the beginning of the show, that it's going to be a combination of the two. I don't think there's universal Democratic support for all of the $1 billion that Pritzker's looking for out of the business taxes. And I think there is still, you know, some belief here that some of those business tax incentive items that were entered into a couple of years ago were done in a good faith effort. And again, while the economy seems to be taking off, this isn't necessarily a great time to start throwing taxes at the business community.
So, Hannah, I look back and I think about how budget negotiations went for decades, and you would always see at this time of the year the Republicans, the Democrats, the leadership getting behind closed doors, working together, trying to come up with something. Is that what's happening now? Democrats have the votes, have enough support at least there to possibly move some of this stuff on their own. Are we seeing bipartisan work on a budget?
Not really. In 2019, obviously, for Governor Pritzker's first term, I think there was so much relief on both sides to be out from under the thumb of Bruce Rauner. And so there was, you know, an eagerness to work together. And it was the first bipartisan budget that I've seen in a while. Although I guess, you know, breaking the budget impasse in 2017, is a different story. But, there haven't been any of those bipartisan leaders meetings. I think Jim Durkin was asked this week, the last time that he spoke to the governor, and it wasn't, you know, hadn't been since a month ago or so. And so, no, there isn't really, I think, the Republicans' top budgeteers, might be consulted, but for the most part, they, claim that they're being shut out.
Let me move on to another topic that's, of course, certainly of interest to lawmakers especially, and that is redistricting. And Rick, this, of course, comes up every 10 years based on census data. Is there anything here that's going to hold up the Democrats getting this done by their deadline that they're trying to move?
If there's something that's going to hold up anything, it's going to be infighting in the ranks among Democrats who aren't happy that their district doesn't have enough friendly territory. That's the only thing that could hold this up. But they know that the clock is running. They have to be done by June 30th, or they're basically giving Republicans a 50-50 shot in a lottery to control the map-making process. And, you know, you can argue that as, hey, Democrats, you know, we're a team here, all that kind of thing. But there's nothing more politically personal than the drawing of these map lines. And it's drawing a little bit of consternation among some freshman House members, some of the newer members. Senators, not so much from the ones I've talked to. We heard that the map will be out there soon, but you know, as we're looking at, and with a vote aimed at before May 31st, well, that doesn't really give a whole lot of time for all of these promises of transparency that all of these various good government and racial and ethnic rights groups have been looking for in going through the map. Plus, until the map's out, we're not going to know exactly where the data is that they're using to put these maps together, because the actual census figures that the state spent $31 million to help get that census number accurate, they're not going to be out until at the earliest mid-August.
Well, Rick, we've watched this process in the past. We've become pretty accustomed to the fact that Michael Madigan, the former Speaker of the House, was heavily involved in this. Is the process different this time because Madigan's not there? Have you heard anything about that?
I've heard it's a little bit different, but again, you've got a lot of new members that have shown up in the House over the last 10 years in the last remap. So it's a new process for a lot of members, and I'm not so sure. You know, obviously Madigan, known for his map making skills, but there's still a lot of folks that have worked in the mapping process before. It's almost like a group that comes alive every 10 years. Those people are around, they know what they're doing. And as I said, the only difference this time is they're using estimates rather than actual census data. It's going to go, as we all know, these things are going to go to court anyway. But eventually it's a matter of, are Democrats comfortable with the map lines enough? Or, you know, is there some payback if you get some Democrats that may go renegade and start voting against things like the budget and other things because they're not happy with the map lines they got?
So, Charlie, you've watched this through the years, too. Is it that uncommon to see Democrats or whatever parties in control not happy with the territory in the map that finally does come out?
Yeah, I think as Rick said, every incumbent wants a more favorable district. They want, in the case of Democrats, they want more sure Democratic voters and fewer Republican voters. The difficulty for the Democrats with their supermajority is that a lot of those folks are from suburban areas that historically have been solidly Republican, but because of the Republicans' kind of hard charge to the right, the cult of Trump, the demographic changes bringing more people of color into those areas, they become more favorable to Democrats. But there's no sure thing. And so that's what they're looking for. And I think still the bottom line is, even though you're unhappy with the district that they've given you, you want more Democrats than what they've given you, you can be pretty darn sure if you're in the suburbs and the Republicans draw the map, you are up the creek without a paddle. And so that would be my argument to these newbies who think they're getting shafted. If you think we're doing it to you, wait till you see what the Republicans do if they get to draw the map. because at the risk of sounding like a tonal cynic, all this notion about transparency and bringing the people in and blah, 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 all the goo-goo stuff, whichever party controls the map making is not going to pay any attention to any of that. Were the roles reversed, the Republicans would be steaming ahead and the Democrats would be crying foul. That's just the nature of the game. And you were talking before about whether Mike Madigan's presence is still there. He may or may not be, but I noticed that one of the consultants that the Democrats have hired is a fellow named Kim Brace. Now, Kim Brace was the main architect of the map back in 1981 that enabled Madigan to become House Speaker, and it allowed the Democrats to control the legislature for the next 10 years, despite the fact that there was a Ronald Reagan reelection during that span, and despite the fact that in one election, they didn't even have a candidate for governor because of a mess up that allowed two extremists to win the primary for lieutenant governor and secretary of state. So that gives you an idea of how good Brace is at what he does.
He is the guru. There is no doubt about that.
Yeah.
Well, Hannah, before I move on to another topic, that transparency issue, Democrats, you know, you can't have it both ways. You can't tout this that you're going to do it a certain way. And when you don't, not expect some blowback for that. What are the Democrats saying now? I mean, it's becoming pretty obvious we're not going to see the transparency that they had promised earlier.
Yeah, I mean, some of the leaders in the redistricting efforts in the House and Senate had said in separate occasions that they wanted the maps to be public for 2 weeks before they take a vote. Obviously, that's not going to happen now. There's too much time has passed. But they're getting dinged pretty hard on so-called transparency. Of course, they counter with, well, we had, you know, 30 hearings all across the state, a lot on Zoom, but like, you know, people didn't really show up. It was just the same good government groups going to testify. But, I think that the other thing here is that when you say they can't have it both ways, they also can't have it both ways, but they're trying to get, they're pretty well getting away with it, to be honest, about the census numbers. The governor says, well, you know, look at our census. We did so much better than anyone thought. You know, we didn't lose nearly as much population as had been estimated. But yeah, we're going to go ahead and use the ACS data instead, even though that's the data that gave us these like pretty, unreliable estimates of what's going on actually, you know, on the ground in Illinois. And so, they're trying to have it both ways. And I mean, I think that's something that they're succeeding at, to be honest.
And like Charlie has said in the past, this is not something that the average citizen is really often paying attention to. It's a very political, almost insider process. But one of the things that the average person does pay a lot of attention to is the size of their power bill. And Exelon has been asking for more subsidies to come from state government to help them. Exelon, of course, the parent company of Commonwealth Edison. And Rick, the latest now is they're basically threatening more nuclear plant closures than what they had already threatened earlier. Trying to put state governments over a barrel here, is that going to be successful?
Well, despite the efforts of how Exelon and ComEd aren't going to have the freewheeling that they had in the past before the feds cracked down, they're still going to the full court press. And originally it was just two nuclear plants that they were looking for subsidy ratepayer help to maintain. Now they've thrown all four of their plants in. You've got the factor of organized labor now even more hyped up because of the threatened job losses of losing four plants instead of two. You've got the cries for reform that we can't let Commonwealth Edison just dictate its way. They have to pay a penalty along with the $200 million fine that they agreed to pay the feds for trying to influence Mike Madigan. This is a tough one. It's a really tough one. And you also have the effort of, you know, trying to move towards a more green energy economy. And the governor's weighed in with his proposal on trying to move us forward on that. I don't know that we end up with a energy deal here in this short amount of time that's left.
Just a couple of minutes left here. And Rick, I want to ask you, you wrote about this week, that this was this vote in Congress, so not in Springfield, but in Washington, where there was a vote on having a commission to investigate and review the January 6th insurrection that took place. A lot of members of the Republican Party don't want to see that happen, and they have voted against it. Some Republicans, though, said yes, and that split was even on display in the Illinois delegation. So tell us about that.
Well, this would be a bipartisan, equal member commission to look into the insurrection and the causes that led to it. Republican leadership in the House, Kevin McCarthy, dead set against it. Mitch McConnell over in the Senate, dead set against it. It's not likely to ultimately happen because of the even split among Republicans and Democrats in the Senate. But in the House, it passed with 35 Republicans that bucked McCarthy and House GOP leadership. And what I found interesting was obviously Adam Kinzinger, one of the 10 Republicans that voted for Donald Trump's second impeachment. Kinzinger voted for the January 6th commission, but also joining that was Rodney Davis from Taylorville. And Rodney's always had a very good, close relationship with McCarthy, Steve Scalise, and House Republican leadership. So it was very interesting that he decided to make a move to buck leadership on this. I mean, one thing is, if you know it's not going to happen in the Senate, you know, consider it maybe a free political vote to try to show that he's got some distance between leadership, Republican leadership, and who he is. The other part is, you know, a lot of talk about if he gets redistricted in a bad way, that he could run for a statewide office like governor.
Charlie, do you think that may have played into that decision by Davis?
Oh, yeah. I think, as Rick said, it was pretty much a freebie vote in terms of it having any real world impact. And he's trying to establish that he's really not as much of a Trump supporter as his voting record would make you think. And as Rick said, he's possibly looking at a run for higher office. And ironically, if he does wind up in a district with, say, Mary Miller, that vote may hurt him in a Republican primary, but it certainly wouldn't hurt him in a general election. But so we'll just have to see where it goes from here.
But Rick, one of the people who did vote, voted no on having that commission was Darren LaHood. That is the son of Ray LaHood. He's really set himself up to be, you know, he's a central Illinois congressman, but he's quite conservative, and he's sort of all in on the Trump bandwagon, it seems.
Yeah, and you know, as much as we talked about Democratic legislative districts in the suburbs, when you look at downstate Illinois, and yeah, there are certain things that the Democrats could do in a congressional map, but Darren LaHood and the district he has, and however you want to try to redraw it, you can't draw it in a way that is going to hurt Darren LaHood. Right. So that's just a hard red area that he's got.
Let's go to our notes from the field. And Hannah, let's start with you.
Sure. So Auditor General Frank Montino, the Illinois Supreme Court, extended his legal drama just for a little bit longer. If you'll recall, he was a Democratic legislator for many years. And almost as soon as he became Auditor General, this watchdog group said, you know, oh, he was actually breaking the law by spending $250,000 on fuel and car repairs at this gas station in his hometown. And after a lot of legal machinations over the last 5+ years, the Illinois Supreme Court said, actually, yes, but he has a defense. And even if the Board of Elections, you know, actually finds that he did, in fact, violate the law, there's no way to punish him because they can't find a defunct committee.
Shirley?
Okay, following up on Hannah's mention of a Supreme Court opinion, I'll mention another one that came down this week. You may recall that some time ago, John Tillman, who was the chief executive officer of the Illinois Policy Institute, which bills itself as a libertarian think tank, filed a lawsuit, and he claimed that states' pension bonds issued in 2003 and other general obligation bonds issued in 2017 violated the state constitution because they didn't specify a particular purpose for which they were going to be used. Well, the Supreme Court decided that no, he was wrong. And they pointed out that the state, in the case of the 2003 bonds, spent the money for years and years and years while Tillman did nothing. More than 16 years later, he requested the court declare the bonds invalid and enjoined the state from making future payments. And there's still like $14 billion that we have to pay. The court said, basically, he waited too long. And I think Comptroller Susana Mendoza had the most succinct response or reaction to the court opinion. She says, the Supreme Court of Illinois got it right. The taxpayers of Illinois should not have to suffer financial Armageddon just so rich people who bet against Illinois can profit. Never bet against Illinois.
And Rick?
Well, Illinois lost a real trailblazer this past week when Corrine Wood of Lake Forest died on Tuesday of complications related to breast cancer. The first female lieutenant governor. She was on the 1998 Republican ticket with George Ryan. And she was basically picked as a, you know, pro-choice, very women's rights activist to counterbalance George Ryan, who was a conservative. He opposed the Equal Rights Amendment, opposed abortion rights as Speaker of the House. And it's kind of funny, and Charlie probably remembers this too, is how this ticket actually became almost more liberal than the Democratic ticket with Glenn Pichard. Wood went on to try to run for governor herself after George Ryan enmeshed in scandal, only served one term. She finished third in the Republican primary. But still stayed very active in civic life. So condolences to Corrine Wood and her family.
And it's a good point. And also two giants of journalism who recently passed away wanted to make note of. Paul Davis, who became news director of WGN-TV. He was a downstater, though, born in Effingham, got a start at WCIA-TV in Champaign, was news director there as well. Still active in his later years with the Illinois News Broadcasters Association, helped to mentor young reporters. And Dick Kay, who was a longtime political reporter. He was with WMAQ-TV for nearly 40 years. He certainly had no problem throwing hard questions to politicians in the statehouse back when Chicago stations still had people in Springfield on a regular basis. Both those gentlemen will be missed. That's all the time we have for this episode of State Week. Our panel included Charlie Wheeler, Hannah Meisel, and the Chicago Tribune's Rick Pearson. You can get a podcast of our show at nprillinois.org or through the NPR One app. And join us next time. I'm Sean Crawford.
You've been listening to State Week, a program of commentary and analysis of events in Illinois state politics and government. State Week is produced in the state capitol by public radio station NPR Illinois. This is IPR, Illinois Public Radio.